Did Colorado beat Minnesota, or did VAR beat Minnesota? It's That's So MLS. When two VARs or four VARs are better than one. This is a North American soccer podcast with myself, Nick Thornton. With me always is Andrew Bates. Andrew, how are you this week?
Nick, I'm doing great. The games, in one sense, left something somewhat to be desired, but from a Whitecaps perspective. But, you know, there's not always a lot to complain about because, you know, the soccer was good. And and to a certain degree, the Whitecaps, we already knew that scenario was not necessarily going to go well anyways. So on a decent international break, it was reasonably there was a reasonably pleasant slate of MLS games to take a look at.
Yeah, it was nice that although it was a bye week for many teams, we did get to see a few games. And if I'm honest, this is the part of the season where I get a little overwhelmed with soccer, and it just feels like there's so much soccer happening that you're never on top of it. So it was nice to have a week of a bit of reprieve, and just there was only a few games going on, and it was a little bit easier to keep track of what was going on at any given time.
And we ended up having some reasonably, you know, momentous things happen anyways.
Mm-hmm.
You, if I recall, were at Whitecaps Kansas City. Do we want to start there? Do we want to start there? Do we want to end there?
Let's end there, because that will lead nicely into our guest conversation tonight.
Yeah, we've got a special guest. Well, then the other thing, the game you mentioned in one of the games I got to see a little bit of midweek, although I guess I didn't see it in its full glory, was Colorado Minnesota.
Yes.
Quite the thing that game. So this is one where the highlights package, like I said, I kind of had this one on at work at the time. So I have it on in the background. So I didn't get all of the sort of like disallowment drama, but many of the plays themselves were not on the highlights package. So I had to go like back and do this Zapruder back and to the left sometimes to find out what they actually thought had happened. And, oddly, I guess, so the deal was that Minnesota had two disallowed goals, which would have made it, well, like 2-2, but who knows if Colorado would have scored that second goal. Colorado ended up winning 2-0. First one, legit. Second one, worries me. What do you think?
Yeah, having not really looked at the replays a ton of those angles, it's hard to say. I think, for me, let's just also start off with, I think this game was destined to just be a total nut house of a game. Because it's something like in the first 10 minutes, there's this mad scramble in Minnesota's box where Colorado has like five or six chances, and it's just like a guy kicking the ball at close range, it like flies into the goalkeeper's face, falls to another rapid player. The rapid player like whiffs it again and it hits the post. Like it's just this like total, like it's like a slapstick routine of somebody trying to put the ball in the net and it doesn't happen. And I feel like even at that point, you had to sense like, okay, what are we about to witness here? Of two teams that have already been eliminated and have struggled, but we've also seen that both teams have had some good attacking prowess in their seasons, if not defensive prowess.
Yes.
I actually felt like the first goal looked a little bit more like a clear-cut call than the second one. It's just unfortunate when VAR becomes the focus of a game. And for me, regardless of what the calls are, the fact that it took so long and there was so much added time and that so late in the game to disallow a goal as well, which ended up resulting in like 12 minutes of added time once it was all said and done, really does kind of put a blemish on this game. So for me, it's kind of depends on how you want to look at it. Do you want to look at it as, did they get the calls right, or did they get the calls wrong, or did they just spend too much time looking at these things And we're in arguably a potential era of VAR where referees are no longer making decisions on the field. They're relying on VAR, which, as we've seen in the last couple of weeks, can also cause problems and misinterpretations. As even MLS acknowledged last week, there was a clear error made from the VAR replay.
I think that what was that situation? Because I never caught wind of that.
Shoot, I knew you were going to ask me. Let's keep digesting the game, right? And I'll sort of try to find it in the background.
Well, it's sort of the thing, you know, that I we're going to talk, I think, when we talk about the...
Oh,
the...
it was LAFC and SKC. It was the penalty call for LA.
Right, which we had both kind of been a little concerned about.
Yeah, and then Peter Vermees was subsequently fined for criticizing the referee. And the same day, MLS was like, oh yeah, they super made the wrong call. But also, you're fined for saying it, because you're not allowed to say it.
Why are you booing me? I'm right!
Drain my bank account.
So I think the first one, I mean, it's all about, you know, we're going to sort of, I think the Canada women's game is going to kick up some of these discussions somewhat. But like, you know, it's all about, you know, justice. If there's two legitimate if one team has two legitimate handball or two goals called back and no other goals, that's going to seem, that's always going to seem iffy. Even if, you know, it's just going to be unfortunate. That first one from Ibsen, I think that you can pretty much, I guess, see where they were coming from.
Mm-hmm.
The Minnesota one was the one that I zap-rooted, where it was like, it didn't seem that clear to me how Angelo, like if anything, it had seemed to me like it was one of those, like, you know, attacking player has pinky over the imaginary line, therefore offside,
mm-hmm.
sort of deals. The commentators seemed to be pretty clear about it, so maybe there was just something I was not getting. But it was just a frustrating scenario because is you know, second away win of the season for Colorado, but like, you know, at least looking from what I was able to see, it kind of did seem like Minnesota had a lot of control over the game.
It did, and that's the unfortunate thing here, is regardless of which you consider right or wrong, it means that really the story of the game looks like Colorado was gifted this game. And I think you could make a fairly safe argument that they were. Another way of looking at it is we have two minnows of MLS, at least this season, battling it out for, you know, the mud trophy. And does it really matter? And I think a few people have sort of put that as well. But it's frustrating for the fans who have invested a lot in it, who want to see a good game of soccer. And it's unfortunate, but also sometimes, like, we've all seen games like that or played in games like that where you do just need a referee's decision on something, and it is really close. And sometimes it's a game of fine lines.
The one, at least in Colorado's favor, I did look it up. They did lead in shots, 12-10, 7-1 on target they led, and they did have 52.8% of possession. So I guess, like, there's a really funny 5-minute period where if you look at the 5-minute intervals graph, they had a good chunk of the first half too. But like, the reason why they controlled so much of half the game and only got 52.8% is that they were then nearly they didn't have very much time on the ball at all in the second, including one area where they had in 5 minutes 0% possession, which is a new one for me.
Yeah. I think the most interesting thing about this match is that when Tommy Smith celebrated in front of the Minnesota bench and the Minnesota crowd, yes. Harrison Heath got up and started shoving him, which resulted in Tommy Smith getting sent off and Harrison Heath. But I also somehow didn't piece together that Harrison Heath is the son of Coach Adrian Heath. So I kind of love that, like, you've got, like, you can't do this to my dad.
It's you just can't do this to my dad? That's my dad!
It's my dad! And just hijinks ensue. And it really kind of sums it up, right? It's like a game that neither team really deserved to win. And both teams get people sent off right at the end, in deep into, like, the 12th minute of stoppage time. I think this might have been the worst game in MLS this season.
Ooh, that's one to look back on. I don't know that I could say that for sure.
That's true. Well, yeah, that's right. Okay. But I'm sure there's at least five Orlando games that have.
At the very least, this one was interesting. Like, this one wouldn't top my list just because, like, you know, stuff happened.
It had it all.
Now we talked about, you know, these two Minnow or Minnow adjacent teams. I feel like we've spent a lot of time the last few weeks asking, how is LAFC in as good of a position as they are, and why is Houston in as bad of a position as it is? And there was this brief moment in the LAFC-Houston game where it looked like they were kind of in the same place, and then LAFC just drove them into the ground.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's happened a lot to Houston this season, is that they've shown moments of composure and brilliance and then just kind of collapsed. But also, taking nothing away from LAFC, and I think it helped that this week there were fewer games, so it was easier to pay attention to LAFC and see what they do right, which is that they can go down and come back and score goals, you know, as a team and as a unit, in a really effective way, and to not just give in. And that's where this weekend was the one that made me just go, I have no idea who's going to end up in the MLS final, and I have no idea who's favored to win it, because I think there's five or six teams right now that on any given night could beat any other team and look the part. So yeah. You can talk about form and you can talk about consistency, but once we're into the playoffs, all of that is kind of written off. And some of those teams that we've said, you know, are impossible to beat or the strong contenders have shown their weaknesses. And you begin to go, why not LAFC this year?
That's right.
With the kind of goal scoring that they're able to do, you know, when they come back in a big way.
the opening goal is scored by Houston I have written down here, great tackling from LA, but no movement. Everybody ended up being focused on this move of an LA defender tackling at very low speed, and everybody's watching to see how it's going to turn out. So as soon as a Houston attacker gets a hold of it and sends it into the middle, all of a sudden play speeds up really fast. And Marlon Otis is in the right place. He scores as he is wont to do.
Yeah. Well, I think it also can't be overstated that the hour and 45-minute delay in the middle of this game also probably changed the tempo a little bit.
Yes.
And it's funny, when you see that first goal, it is truly bucketing, like, it hasn't rained in an MLS game in a long, long time. So it's always hard to say with games like that, because after you've just waited longer than the length of an actual game to get back on the pitch and play, I'm sure that, you know, mindsets have changed. People are maybe not staying fresh. They're finding it difficult to cramp or difficult to avoid cramping up. I don't want to make excuses for anyone, but I think that LAFC had a very, very long time to regroup and figure out what they were going to do.
For the longest time, they've had this issue where they collect so many forwards, and then it's the center backs that get the most sort of, you know, that actually create the most finish. And we did see Walker Zimmerman score here, but the thing that what I think that a big spark for them is Carlos Vela being rightly fouled by the Houston goalkeeper Tyler Derrick.
Do you mean rightly fouled or rightly awarded a penalty?
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, fouled and rightly awarded a penalty. Sorry, yes, of course. I wasn't saying he should have been fouled.
But I mean, it's one way of goalkeeping.
He collects a legitimate penalty, and it really sort of fires him up. He got 2 goals, 2 assists. I felt like this is the right time for Bela and Diego Rossi to fire up. I think that through stretches in the middle part and towards the end of the season, we haven't seen that to the degree that they need.
Yeah.
And so, you know, no better time than right now.
Absolutely. As I've just said that, you know, form isn't everything. We have seen year after year heading into the playoffs, you know, how you played in your last five games leading into it really does seem to have some impact on where you end up in the playoffs.
The other thing I want to note is that with Andrew Eger getting the second goal for Houston, maybe it's not fair to say this against a team that's offensively as dangerous as LAFC, but this year, the offense of the Houston Dynamo have delivered. They have been let down somewhat by their defense. 54 goals scored, 54 goals against.
Yeah.
Or 53 and 53 tells the story of, you know, there's no way that you can say that they're not pulling their weight on the front line there.
Absolutely not. And that's where Houston has been sort of up and down. But I agree, their front three or their front four or whatever you want to call it, I feel like have been exceptionally quick. Their crosses into the box have been much better than a lot of teams. They look very, very dangerous from that perspective. But you're right in that they are getting let down at the back half. And if they could tighten that up, I think you'd see more 2-0, 2-1 wins for Houston to just sort of take care of business at the back. But they just seem a little bit too easily beaten and get very scrambled. Because LAFC scores three of those goals within a sort of 15-minute stretch.
Yes. The other thing to note with... Yes. We're still all talking about that week's games. Is the... I don't know if I caught much of the midweek stuff, but they also lost to Seattle, which was another up and down week. Or was that last week? No, that was from last week.
Yeah.
What am I saying? You had... you had mentioned this sort of idea that one team... Like, you know, teams... right now could beat any other team. And when you say that, what I think of is SC Dallas versus DC United. DC hosting Dallas on the weekend. And in the now the number six team having officially passed the impact. The last team in the East beating in the Eastern Conference playoff teams beating the first team in the Western Conference.
Yeah. And I really didn't know how this one would go. I really, really thought this could be potentially a thorn in DC's side, that Dallas might just find a way to break them down or at least hold them off. And that's more or less what happened for much of the match, is we've seen Dallas struggled to get many decent chances on net, but were able to keep things relatively defensively compact.
Mm-hmm.
However...
Things got bonkers,
and DC showed that, you know, in terms of grit, in terms of just sheer willpower to win a game, and not just get a result, but win a game, right now there's no other team like DC United.
Yeah.
And I feel like it might be a little bit of like the Leicester effect, where they're seeing this exceedingly good run of form, and that's bolstering them. But it doesn't matter what it is. They're just brimming with confidence and just a sense of, yeah, we can absolutely find a way to win this game.
I almost don't want to complain about this in a sour grapesy kind of way, because they're not the first team and they won't be the last team to have this kind of scheduling thing happen to them. But, man... having all their away games before they got Wayne Rooney, and then having all of their home games after they got Wayne Rooney in a row when they were in blistering form, certainly didn't hurt one bit.
It really didn't. But to be fair, that also meant they had to play a massive amount of games in a very small stretch of time. So the fact that they've been able to add depth to their team, be relatively injury-free, play with their full roster because they've had to... Not that every team hasn't had to do it, but they were doing it in quite a late part of the season, because for much of the season, they were playing with four or three games in hand against every other team. So, I mean, that is also it to consider, is all of these players had to show up and perform many times in a short period of time.
I love the goal here, which is a defensive header from Dallas falls to Russell Knauss, who hits it off the crossbar. It bounces to Birnbaum, and he sends it back towards Knauss, who heads it home. Great resilience to stay on the play from Knauss.
Absolutely. Arguably my favorite last name in MLS as well.
Oh, it's true. Oh, and it all is set up by Rooney first, of course. It all comes in the 86th minute. So a stalemate that bounces loose by Knauss.
Yeah, and again, it was... I posted the goal on Instagram of just like, this goal actually sums up DC United more than any other goal. Maybe perhaps the amazing tracking run that Rooney did to find the incredible long ball. I forget which game that was, but the work ethic is there, but also just the, like, there's such a slim chance of that ball going in. It just needs somebody to get their big head behind it and bash it into the far post. And that's what they were able to do. And, you know, and I think Knauss at the end also had like a big gash across his nose. Like, they're putting absolutely everything into this. And it's really, really hard not to be cheering for DC United right now as a team.
I have to give a shout out, as you mentioned, the tracking back DC goal to Mike Pendleton, Fat7Deuce on Twitter, who took the tracking goal in several other key plays from MLS and otherwise, and sent it to Jerry Rafferty's Baker Street.
Nice.
One of my favorite 80s and 90s songs. And it's glorious. Yes, absolutely. You said it at the start of the when we were talking about them, the ability to hold together and work towards a result, as opposed to in the other game that we see on Wednesday when they face TFC, they definitely do benefit from the skill of Wayne Rooney on a dead ball situation, scoring the only goal of the game in a real tight one. They benefit from the skill in that case, but most of the time they're benefiting from work.
And it's great to be benefiting from both. That's the key thing here. It's great to see an underdog team. It's great to see a team play together and play with grit and all of that. But they also have a little bit of magic up their sleeves. And we've seen teams in MLS that are successful, as we've seen with Seattle and last year with Toronto, is teams that can play in multiple different gears and modes with multiple different lineups and just find a way to get it done. Whether that's through a brilliant free kick, a last-ditch header, whatever the thing may be, it doesn't really matter. The teams that don't do so well are teams that, you know, like, and not naming any local teams, but teams that are great on a counterattack, but that's the only weapon they have in their arsenal. And so when they play a more direct team, they really, really struggle.
Yeah, that's you, especially in a league like this, where, you know, I do think that to a certain degree, there are, if not like sort of a variety of different styles, the fact that so many teams are personality based through just sort of loading up on attackers, it kind of is, you know, you kind of have to work on having a recipe to close down individual, you know, how am I closing down Nico Ladero? How am I closing down Jovinko? How am I closing down Rooney? Right? Like, strategies are a little more personalized, I think. Mm-hmm. So to be able to use multiple different styles will make you better, in a matchup situation.
Absolutely. And also, if you happen to have arguably one of the world's best free kick takers on your side, that also helps. Because I know I finally had to text my friend who's a big Manchester United fan, and I've always ragged on Rooney. And I just sent her a text this weekend, and I just sent multiple clips of Rooney in a row where I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm a changed man. You know what? He's working harder here than he ever did in the Premier League. And you could tell he likes the team and he's enjoying playing soccer. And for me, that's always fun to see, and not something you always see from players that come in here to the quote-unquote retirement league.
No. I didn't pick up much from Orlando versus Seattle, where Seattle won 2-1.
No, there. Yeah, this one I was actually quite surprised that was the end result. Dom Dwyer sort of came to life and got something back, but I don't think it's any big surprise here, and I don't really think Seattle put out their strongest lineup. This wasn't one they needed to crucially win, and I felt like they knew they could win it with a slightly weakened squad, but not a terribly interesting match either.
You know, it's sad for Orlando that this is what things have turned into for them. But you know, this is the kind of result that you need to get when you play Orlando this season. New England also got it on the weekend when they beat Orlando 2-0 at home. Unfortunately, as we're recording this on Wednesday, they are not currently getting it. They are 3-0 down to Real Salt Lake at halftime.
Yep. New England is, not Orlando. Just to clarify for listeners.
Yeah, New England is down, which is great news for RSL. Bad news for the Galaxy. But it will be interesting to see how that whole situation shakes out. And I think that leaves us with Vancouver.
You are correct. Or did we want to talk about international?
Well, we just do. Let's do Vancouver and then cover that and then hit international.
Okay. Okay.
So,
yes.
I guess all I could say is comparing this game to the FC Dallas 2-1 loss that got Carl Robinson fired. Is it seemed like, you know, it might have came, or like, didn't even really come early in the game because the Vancouver had the lead, KC tied, Vancouver got tired, KC pushed ahead late on, and then at that point, it had really seemed like the go-ahead goal was on the 82nd minute, and then Kansas City scored. There was just no sense of an ability to tie it up or a will to tie it up. The air was out of the season at that point. The air was out of the team. The defense absolutely did not track back, which enabled Johnny Russell and Kyrie Shelton to take all the time they wanted to get their markers to commit and then just lay the ball easily into the middle. For the eventual goal scorers.
I mean, having been there, anybody who watched the game from anywhere, whether you were there or you saw it on TV, all saw the same thing happen. But I thought we played exceptionally well for 60 minutes. And how many times has that been said this season? A very thin lineup. We're missing 6 players through international involvement. Russell Tybert played a full 90 the day before, flew back and was on the bench and did end up seeing some time.
That's wild to me.
It is wild. And it's also, it says a lot about a player who's tracking back in the 95th minute. The only player tracking back to try to defend was Russell Tybert. And we'll talk more about him in a second. But for 60 minutes, they did everything right. They pressed high. Sporting Kansas City loves to control possession, loves to press. Vancouver was going equal with them. There was never a moment to dwell on the ball for Sporting Kansas City. And Vancouver hasn't always shown that ability. They were always closing down space, making it frustrating. They get the goal, which is fantastic. Felipe finally gets on the score sheet from a poor clearance. I mean, when was the last time Vancouver scored off of a poor clearance instead of the other way around? And, you know, there was a real sense sort of at the break of like, if we play like this, we could do it. And yeah. I think that's the real frustrating, heartbreaking thing for most Whitecaps fans is there have been plenty of moments where we go, we could just do this. And there's been 4 or 5 moments this season where we have done it against much better clubs. But ultimately, the personnel on the pitch didn't have the mental ability or the physical ability to stand up to it. The first goal, I think, is forgivable. Quaze just smashes it in. He is getting closed down. There's a couple of slips in the box that allow a bit of space, but it happens. I think that a 1-1 scoreline at that point was fair.
Yeah.
And probably would have happened regardless. But everything after that is just players switching off, players not getting into position, players forgetting about the game plan, and the wheels just completely coming off the cart. And it's all the same stuff we've talked about, you know? Breck Shea wins how many balls down the wing, runs down, blasts it into nowhere. He's got people beside him wide open. You know, Kai Kamara brings it down. He's ready with a shot and blasts it over to the crossbar because he doesn't get his feet right. Just the final little bit of quality there, and I don't want to heap much of the blame on Kai Kamara because he's one of the few players that has shown up consistently this year. But it was just a complete and utter capitulation yet again. And I think I haven't seen BC Place empty that fast ever. At the third goal, literally thousands of people were streaming out. And that was, I believe, in like the 82nd minute or so. So, you know, we've still technically got a hope. And the stadium just emptied. And that's got to be disheartening for the players. But also, I think there's a mutual sense of just really being let down. It's like, if we're going to go down, can we not go down swinging? But as you mentioned, nobody was tracking back. Nobody was making an effort. And it really showed that guys like Aaron Mond and Jose Aja aren't fit to play a full match. And that's not acceptable at this point in the season, because we knew this international break was coming.
It's like the weird thing about this period, and it's still the case, although, you know, coming into this game, the thought was, it's 3-in. You have to win all 3 games, but if you do it, you're in. Well, really, if you look at the standings, even though Real Salt Lake is winning right now, they only have one more game left in the regular season, so it's kind of it's 2-in now. If the other two teams win one and lose one, LA Galaxy and Real Salt Lake, and the Whitecaps win both, that's not a theoretically unreasonable thing that could happen, except that the will in the everybody's belief in where those three teams are at in terms of, will the other two drop one, and can Vancouver really hold it together to do it? You know, they have the talent in them that they could beat LAFC and Portland, even though that, you know, your heart always jumps in your throat when you try to predict a win against Portland. Mm-hmm. It's not out of the realm of possibility. But the way that the Whitecaps have been playing, you just don't have confidence that they are able to deliver that result.
No, and I mean, the who knows, you know, against, they're going away to LAFC. I don't have high hopes for that game, obviously. But we'll hopefully be back at full strength. And so you never know. Maybe we pull one more out of us, and who knows what happens in Portland. Because we said the same thing going into Toronto, right? There was no way we were going to get a result there, and we did. And we've done it against some big clubs. The thing that stands out for me about this game, and this is me trying to take a bit more of the long view, is that Russell Tybert was not requested by the media to do an interview. And he was the only player that did an interview. Apparently the media room was just told, Russell Tybert's coming in to address you. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Okay, after this, you need to go watch it. And I felt bad because he really does just sort of take it on his shoulders. And I at first thought, like, of course they're going to send out the kid that everyone loves to take the heat from the media and the fans. And he just comes in and goes, I've never seen us play like that before and give up so much. And says, it's completely unacceptable and everybody needs to decide, you know, whether or not we're going to actually do this thing.
Yeah.
And really takes responsibility. And at first I was like, Russell's one of the only players this season who consistently has not given up and shown some pride in it and shown the ability to maintain his fitness and play at a top, top level. Although he's certainly a player that falls under people's radars often. And a player that's still learning the game. And at the same time, the glimmer of hope again, trying to take the long view here, is I think we know who our next captain needs to be.
Oh, yeah.
Because to have a player who's finally reached that level of maturity, has the on-field work ethic, clearly understands the game as well and is trying to organize players, just because the players around him didn't rise to the occasion or follow directions, that's not a knock on him, that's a knock on them. And so I feel like it, more than just sort of a symbolic rallying cry of, you know, okay, you all need to go take a good hard look in the mirror, I felt like it was a pretty honest assessment of things to say, like, if you're going to be at this club, then give a damn and play your heart out. And if you're not, then leave. And
especially because, you know, everybody, you know, of all the players who, you know, have something to assess about themselves, Tybert is the least of them having played in that game the day before.
Yeah, for a full 90 minutes.
And, you know, you can never say for sure, because, you know, coaches come in, coaches have different priorities. Tybert's own form has gone back and forth between seasons. But I think that if Tybert has a really strong year next year, this will be a very memorable moment in that.
Absolutely. And
the other thing I wanted to ask about is, do you know what the deal was with this Kai Kamara red card?
I don't.
He's sending off?
I was walking out of the stadium as they scored the fourth goal. And truly, like, I've never seen anything like it, even for a Whitecaps match. It was over, the stadium was empty, a few of us tried to stay, and then they scored again, and it was just like, this is just too painful to watch, because they had given up. The word on the street is that Kai Kamara grabbed Johnny Russell by the neck after the whistle, and that's what he got ejected for. I can't find any footage or any verification of that account, but I think it's safe to assume hands were laid upon. So the other thing to consider here is that against LAFC, we will be without the only consistent goal-scoring presence that we've had this season. And because I don't know what happened, I can't say too much more about it. It's just deeply unfortunate that Kai Kamara won't be playing that match, and depending on what happened, may not even get to see the Portland game.
The Caps website, although it does not have any details about what took place, says that he received a red card resulting in a suspension in their next match. So no mention of what happens in Portland. I guess, you know, we will save I was going to ask if he wasn't going to play again one season. He said, we'll save his eulogy. We'll save the Whitecaps eulogy until the moment we know that that's true.
Yeah.
On their years this year. But I got to have this week a pretty interesting and revealing conversation with Peter Zimmerman, the president of the Vancouver Southsiders,
mm-hmm.
In which we talk a little bit about the efforts in some of the developments this week that have happened with the Columbus Crew, Save the Crew, which we'll be talking about, but especially this feeling of inconsistency in the Whitecaps, and also what... a little bit of what you're talking about in terms of the feeling at halftime where it's like, we're up a goal, but can we hold on to it? The belief that we can see these results through. So let's take a listen to that now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm here with Peter Zimmerman of the Vancouver Southsiders, the president. Peter, what is your thoughts on, sort of the era change that the Whitecaps are currently going through with the departure of Carl Robinson?
Era change? Well, that's a weird way to put it. I think it's exciting. It's a bit sad because Robinson has been around for quite a bit. It was his fifth season, I believe. And this was his team, and then he grew together with the team, and he was basically the one constant with all the changes. But it ran its course, and I believe that he has shown his toto with this team. And I think we get to see some changes coming, and hopefully the next coach will be able to get more out of the resources, or maybe he can get more resources or use them differently and get us more success.
What do you look at in the relationship between sort of coaching, like coaching performance and resources? Because in sort of the final days, people were looking of that administration. People were looking at like, well, he has some authority to sign players, but he doesn't have authority over DPs. Do you feel that he has made choices that haven't panned out, or do you think that he's kind of done the best that he could do with what is in front of him?
Well, I mean, he did what he could do with what it was in front of him. I mean, he was involved in most of player decisions, if not all, and it's based on most of his suggestions. So I don't think anybody was really scouting outside of his close group. It looks like that he made mistakes along, like some big, smaller, bigger ones. The system, what they were operating, I think that was not just his in terms of player acquisition and how they filled up the bench, for mm-hmm. example, which a lot of people criticize him for, but I think that was clearly like, it wasn't just him. It was a mandate and a sort of a policy. And to be frank, I don't disagree with it, but I wish we had done more with it. And if we gotten better players for some of those positions, I think it is a good concept to have, but it just didn't play out. So I'm not a big fan of the sign a big name player for X million and then don't fill the bench. Like I'm actually quite for this model of having a strong team and a strong bench and having a consistent and pretty much everybody's paid kind of the same approach. So, but it didn't work out for various reasons, and maybe there will be a change in this policy as well, which would be very exciting and a bit sad for me. But I might make us more money or might get us more success. But we don't really know. That's the weird part right now, is that we are a bit of a limbo. I think it would have been better if we just see him him seeing out the season. So it's a lot cleaner transition to the change, but yeah, this is what we got dealt.
I feel like a lot of people were surprised, you know, why now and not either at the end of the season, or my thought was much earlier in the season.
I don't know. Like as I said, I don't like that it happened now. I don't think it should have happened earlier this season. I think he made more changes again this year, and then he built another squad, like tweaked the squad, and it looked good enough, but it didn't perform well. I think there was also relationship problems after a while with the front office. I mean, we had those. Like, I mean, as outsiders, we had that. We raised the stink after that Kansas City game, and we lost 6-0, and it looked like for me it looked like that he kind of lost the team at that point, like the players.
Yes.
By after the World Cup break, it looked like, I think that's when we found out that the assistant coaching staff isn't getting the automatic contract renewal, or not automatic, the contract renewed, and that I think that's really harmed the relationship between the coaching staff and the front office as well. So it was a weird triangle, and if you put the supporters in that, that was just a very weird setup and just time to be. So in that sense, I think it wasn't that bad that he was let go earlier, but it's certainly not ideal.
That makes sense. What do you think that the relationship with the supporters was like? Because I felt like there were times when everybody was extremely negative, and then, you know, the team itself would kind of have this inconsistency where they would have a game like the 6-0 game, and then they would come back and win the next one.
Yeah, I think inconsistency has been a thing, and it feels like every team in Vancouver is inconsistent all the time. It's like everybody is consistent all the time and then get to, you know, say, oh, you're inconsistent. They were. and there were a lot of highs and a lot of lower lows and higher highs, like in past years. So, I mean, there was a lot of success in the past, and I think the expectations were getting higher and higher as it basically grew into his team, and it just, for some strange reason, it didn't work. And then it may have been, like, as he used to say, fine lines, like just little things which were different. It just, at the end of the day, it didn't work out. So whether it was, you know, like more goals conceded, I think that was part of it. But I don't try to pretend a good soccer analyst. I mean, I could pretend, but I don't like it.
Do you think that fans were impatient, or do you think that, or like Vancouver fans were impatient, or what do you think sort of the perception was?
I don't think Vancouver fans or supporters were impatient. I mean, just 5 years in, right? 5 seasons in, or 4 or 5 seasons in, like you get to grow impatient. I think sometimes the expectations are a bit unrealistic, but again, if in relative to the coach, I think it was reasonable to expect, like, at least at the minimum what was last year, like to reach the playoffs and then just to have a good team and a fun team to watch, which was always something they were trying to sell. To be fair, I think that in the past, like the negative voices started a lot earlier, like a couple of years back. So I think it did grow on a steady pace, and it kind of, in that game, it's really, like, that was for me when we demanded better after that Kansas City game. I was very, very disappointed and mad and sad and all of the above. And it seems like that, not like with the exception of not having a disastrous result like that, things didn't get that much better. I mean, they shown that they actually can play really good, mm-hmm. as we have seen, like sporadically. But it wasn't that, you know, there was always a fear that, hey, we're just gonna get beaten like that again, and it's still hanging in the air.
What do you think matters the most to the team when it comes to the idea of firing a manager or you know, seeking new leadership? Do you think it is, you know, individual results? Do you think it's trophies? Do you think it's a relationship with the fans, a relationship with the front office? What do you think sort of is are their key priorities?
For a coach or like, sorry, I may have
like what do you think question. What do you think, if you were to characterize how they've acted in the past, like for when it comes to coaching changes? It's like, do you think, because I know people were wondering, you know, after the 6-0, well, will this be sacking material, or will going out of the Canadian Championship be sacking material? What do you think that the club cares about the most in terms of, okay, this can't go on?
I think feedback from the fans and the way it turned out to be and the way it looked is renewals. So basically a steady season ticket base. I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's their baseline, what they care about the most. And that may have been one of the reasons they were trying to hold on to him till the end of the season, so it cost them less to fire him, for example. So I think from the Cubs' perspective, I can see this decision mostly being a financial one in many aspects. So at least that's what it looked, and that's how it felt like, the way it was kind of dragged on. And I know they take fans and supporters' feedback very seriously. But then the marketing machine is still working on top of that. So, but I think not getting, like, there were, like, basically those things were nails in the coffin, so to say. But neither of them were enough on their own. But, like, not having the renewals and then basically people actually reacting to those things turned the tide over.
That makes sense. People talk a lot about sort of ambition, and there was those ambition rankings that came out. Would you say that the team is ambitious right now?
the players, yes, the team. yeah, I think that was the most disappointing thing I've read about the Whitecaps in a long time. I know it was sort of out of context a bit, but it was still like it was just disappointing to read. I mean, I wasn't really upset because like, it was just like, what am I going to do with this? So, yeah, it's a weird place to be, and then I think there's that whole efficiency thing is. It just applies. It's a business thing, and I get that comes back to the why I think it was it's a financial decision at the end of the day. Unfortunately, it's like that. I think that showed a bit how this is more about business in certain aspects, and then just about the club to have a successful sports team or a sports club or a football club as they claim to be. So I think they've tried to be both, and it's just sometimes the balance is off.
What would you say the mood is like? Because when I talk to some people, I live in St. John. I haven't been there yet. I haven't been to the stadium yet this season. But some people feel a certain amount of, I don't know if it's fatigue. I've heard of some idea that there's like a little bit of malaise among people who follow the team for a while. Do you think that people are, how do you think people are reacting? Have you seen anything like that set in?
Well, I think I can only interpret that in the context of the last 8 years, and definitely the shine wore off from the first couple of seasons. It really lost this new thing in the city. So yes, that the results are kind of mediocre. I mean, we had some successes and we have seen the bumps, but like just looking at how our membership is steady, it's basically we always have some new people, but we like. Kind of not growing anymore, which is fine, but like, there is the general just sense of like there's no way out of this, sort of like there is nowhere we're going. Like that's where you lose with the we want to be efficient is there is no real ambition what you can get behind. And then after a while, I mean, yeah, like hardcore guys like me, like I'm gonna be behind them because that's what I do, that's what I am, that's what I grew up to be behind the home local team, and that's not a common thing in Vancouver, and then it's really hard to build that if things like this happen, and then yeah, so I think it's a downward trajectory in a way. It has been going down for like maybe 2-3 years now, despite some of the results, but then we got burnt at most of the end of the seasons fairly oddly against rivals. So that's like every beginning of the season we get hype ourselves up and it looks exciting, and then we get crushed at the end, and it's wearing people off, I think. So yeah, I have to agree, there is a bit of a tired crowd, which you can actually, if you end up making the last game at BCPs, I think that's as usual, that's our peak of the season, and then I'm not worried that it won't be, but it's that those peaks are actually getting lower and lower. So there's that.
You had talked a little bit about you talked a little bit about the membership in there was the sort of mid-season issue that happened with the Southsiders this year around the Pride Night game, the Kendall Waston press release, and the fact that there in the ensuing sort of general meeting that came after that controversy, there wasn't, I believe, any contested positions. How have things gone in terms of sort of rebuilding connections with supporters and sort of moving towards next year, sort of since the interim board took over?
Okay. That's villain. Okay. Well, the GM, the no constant contested positions was partially because it was really a rush thing, and we needed to find people who would see the year out. And that's, I'm trying to play this year out the way, like, just carry business. Let's try to be continuous and then like try to set something up for the next board. And we had basically one real issue we had to react to, which was the whole source of the problem or the root of the problem. I believe we addressed that, and then we're trying to be as business as usual as possible. We are, as a group, not really set up to these transitions to happen mid-season. So it's been a weird kind of month or two. I hope there was a lot of interest in playing part of this interim board, but people were a bit wary of jumping in as new with no experience. And we're trying, like, so there is interest, and I based on what happened in the build-up for the GM, I am confident that there will be contested positions. We are also talking about various ways of change the structure of how the board works, where it's going to be, like, how we involve the volunteers a bit more in decision-making and stuff like that. So there's a long discussion to be had and consultation. Hopefully we can carry on so we can get into 2019, I wouldn't say as if nothing had happened, but let's say stronger. I'm not really good at marketing, as you can tell. So.
Has sort of the thing helped resolve the situation somewhat, or is the mood a little different now?
As a weird mood, yeah, I would say. Like, the schedule didn't help, the results didn't help, the coaching change didn't help. Like, everything is about something else right now. So we're trying to pick up the pieces and keep going and just do business as usual as much as possible. And it's kind of hard. And then the news coming out that finally it was publicly public that our old home pub is being shut down completely. That is just trying to build a community, get people into the new pub.
Yeah.
It's almost impossible with that, like, now hanging, like, it's so many things moving around. So, and then we are, yeah, like, trying to get renewals for our GA section next year. So it's been kind of a lot. And there, like, as bad as it sounds, there were sides in this story as well. So, that doesn't help. That never helps. So that, I think there is a lot to be worked on. Yeah. But the focus, yeah, the focus now is get the games, get everything in place, and see how the year. And hopefully we get to go to some playoff games. If the miracle hits, we'll see that in the next couple of games.
Now, there was the one thing that one piece of news that came out that was that has come out this week that is quite positive. Is the news that the Columbus Crew will be staying in Columbus. And I think that Vancouver supporters, like supporters around the league, have been very vocal in their support of that. How do you feel on hearing that news?
Well, I'm super excited. I was, like, actually, I did have a statement made privately to a couple of friends or close by in the supporters. It was like, if Columbus gets relocated, I'm out. I said that, like, not too openly. I wasn't publicizing it but I am super excited that I don't have to even think about that anymore. Yeah, having a team in Columbus and keeping them there is very important. I mean, they are one of the founders of the league. We have seen, thanks to the Save the Crew movement, we have seen the details of how that team was run, some insight, and it was really disappointing. I don't really want to bash too much on Precourt, but I think I could. And I would be right to do so. So I'm very happy for them. I'm very happy for all the supporters, because it just shows how strong we can be if need be. Unfortunately, there is another one brewing in Chicago in the meanwhile. So as we're celebrating this, and hopefully there will be some definitive statements made. I mean, I think the one came out from MLS is pretty much clear-cut, not confirming everything. And the sad part of it is that I feel like that the new teams or clubs trying to come into MLS, one of them got screwed, basically, by this. Luckily not on the expense of the crew. So, I'm very happy, and I don't know if we did enough with the Salsiders to help them, but I think they were very strong in Columbus, and then they got the local support, which is the most important thing to have behind the club and the team and the soccer team. So I'm very happy for them.
That makes sense. It really did feel when it looked like it was up in the air, because you were saying that it would harm your when you were saying that you might go out. I mean, I felt like it was hard. It's hard to have that level of trust, as you know, just to say that you're a fan of the league when your team, if this happened, then maybe the next team could be your team. You know.
On a personal level, I did stop watching NHL games after the last lockout. So it's like I just stopped giving to them, and that's what it felt like. Like, oh, they can just act like a group of franchises, and just not care about the fans and the supporters. And that's like, meanwhile, using marketing. Like, the marketing is mostly about how this is different and how the supporters are part of soccer, and how that's. Like, it's what's driving the league partially, and also like the extra money that they pour in for getting better and better players to improve the soccer. It's hard to be a fan of the league and they just, you know, show you the middle finger every other year.
It is the show's called That's So MLS sometimes for a reason. When you talk about sort of the pouring in of money, the big change, and why I kind of do kind of look at it as an era shift, not just the change of the coach, but also with Alfonso Davies leaving, who certainly was a focal point of the team's promotion this year, that money could potentially lead to some changes in the team, whether it's from a player's perspective or whether or not that money is used to invest in a coach. Where would you like to see that go, and where do you think the team goes from here?
Where would I like to see that money go? I think I would raise the average of what we spend on players, first and foremost, knowing that the coach's salary and the coach's team, like, salary is not part of the salary cap. I think that would be a good way to spend it. But I also know that this was more of an investment paid off. So it's almost like it should also cover residency and all the academy system. What makes this a club? And then I think I would go with like maybe 70% on like the team for the next 3-4 years, and then the rest should be invested back or kept being invested in all the young players, because I think we will need to find not just another Davies and another Tiber, but we need to find players like somewhere in between as well, and not just one per every 3 years, right? And we need to be able to keep those other players, like the Bustoses, the other Kubis, and the Levi's. Like, we need to keep them here if they get it, and improve them and give them a chance. So if we could found another team, like I'm really bitter about losing FC2, but I think that like something like that I would happily spend more than 30% of that money on, because it's we just need it as a club who builds on, you know, getting young players and building them up.
That makes sense. I think that's good. Thank you so much for giving me your time. This was great.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We just heard from Peter Zimmerman, the president of the Vancouver Southsiders. One of the things that we talked about that had a big development this week was the plight of the Columbus crew. And it all sort of kicked off when there was this, on the 12th of October, when there was this strange post from at Save the Crew that says, "Saved the crew. We all did this together." And I posted, "Great news, question mark, exclamation mark."
Yeah.
The word on the street is, and what what MLS has confirmed, is that an ownership group that includes the owner of the Cleveland Browns has stepped up to negotiate to purchase the crew from Precourt Sports Ventures in order to keep it in Columbus, and Precourt will continue to be able to develop Austin FC as an MLS team.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a done deal, so I have my fingers crossed, but, you know, that's tremendous, tremendous news for the supporters in Columbus, and they deserve it a great deal. So it's heartening to see.
It is. And I mean, I understand wanting to announce it right away, perhaps a little prematurely, but I think it also shows that, and even MLS's statement today, is it today or yesterday? It's very cautious, but does seem to signal that it is a case of, you know, the talks are ongoing, final negotiations aren't finished, but things look to be very promising. The one thing I think we can say for certain is that if the deal is finally done, it is because of the incredibly hard work of the fans who threw absolutely everything at this to say, you know, part of the reason why this club is ailing is because we've had a stadium that's been left to just fall into disrepair, and there hasn't been any effort to get behind the club. So you can't blame us for not having massive sellout crowds, but there is a strong fan base that supports this club, and it is worth investing in. So, you know, in terms of being a local soccer fan, there hasn't been much to be excited about. This, to me, was just one of the real uplifting soccer stories. I mean, not just of the week, but of the season, for sure.
It's gone on for longer than this season, to the last year. You know, it's been hanging on over their head. As we were saying even a couple of weeks ago, it's wild that people were still sort of, you know, not... It's wild that it got to this part in the season, and not only is the team competitive, but people are going to the games and continuing to support this club that may not even be interested in hanging around. But it's a real relief, because, you know, it's just a matter of, there is a matter of trust, you know, like there's this issue of, if they had not stuck around, you know, which team is next? What's the next one on the block? And there are other, you know, scenarios around the league to sort of be concerned about when it comes to other teams. But, this is a nice relief. The fact that Columbus and Austin are going to stay in the league, I never thought Austin shouldn't have a team. It's going to be awkward with the two of them in. I, not to be insulting towards their supporters in Austin, but I think if I was in their scenario, I may have been a little bit more gracious towards fans in Columbus that were fighting to keep their franchise, because now they're going to have to share a league.
Yeah, I mean, and I think a lot of fans were. I think, unfortunately, especially through Twitter, we don't always see the best of that. I know there was a number of Crew supporters who did point out how many Austin fans had spoken out about this, that, like, well, yeah, they want a soccer club, but they don't want to steal a soccer club away. And I'm sure there's a lot of shitheads that don't really care. But... I was thinking about that this week is what we may have on our hands, though, is a very interesting, hopefully kind of friendly rivalry now. Not that the two clubs will spend a lot of time playing each other, being in, I would assume, different conferences, but, or maybe not. No, yeah, definitely in different conferences. But I think an interesting storyline, and I hope that that's all it amounts to, is that, you know, in the coming years, these two teams play each other, and we get to be like, "Hey, remember that time that we almost took the club, and now we're having a good scrappy match against each other?" But it's not, you know, there's not a lot of bad blood, but just a little bit of a fire there.
We still don't know which of the two is going to be the expansion team. So there's still the.
Well, and that's the interesting thing, right? Is it doesn't it actually means that Columbus Crew technically, if they're bought, are becoming a new team.
Maybe. Well, maybe the MLS statement dated October 12th is deliciously vague on details in that regard.
Yeah, and I imagine it's because they don't have no idea.
It says that they are launch an MLS club in Austin is the wording. So that would sound to operate Austin FC as a Major League Soccer club. So that is very light on. That would sound like a new franchise, although it is light on. Details. Perhaps you could have like a mini expansion draft where it's just the two teams picking from the old Columbus roster. They split the team in half.
MLS is such a it'd be like a timeshare. It's a very strange world. But I'm over the moon. I'm tentatively over the moon for the Columbus Crew fans who really, gosh, they deserve some good news. I mean, they've had some good news from their team playing well, but it's had this sort of icky, bitter aftertaste of the fact that this team might be, you know, could potentially win MLS Cup and then immediately move and just gut the sport in that city.
Yeah, it would be. It was a really tough time, and it would be a huge relief. Outside of MLS, we had this international break. Both Canadian teams were in action. The Canadian men's national team won 5-0 against Dominica at BMO Field in a midweek game that saw some impressive results from Jonathan David, who scored and had an assist. Alfonso Davies had 2 assists. You had 5 different goals. It's 5 different goal scorers. But of course, it was Dominica. So we're in this. We remain in this Nations League period, where it's still a bit of a crapshoot.
It very much is. It was also nice to see John Herdman put out a youthful squad and be playing around with it a little bit.
Yep.
And looking for young players, and I didn't quite grasp. Although they clearly did their. Media well to really highlight the clubs that these young players were at, even though if they're not actually all playing as starters or even in the first, like in the A team. But I think it is, but at the same time, that's what we need. We need some excitement behind it. And like Tabla deserves some hype.
Barcelona forward Balu Tabla.
And to finally see him play and to see what some of the hype is about. Yeah, they oversold it a bit. They also introduced Alfonso Davies as a Bayern Munich player, which Kai Kamara also called out on Instagram. He's just like, which club does he play for? I don't know about right now, but a little premature on those celebrations. But I hadn't really heard of Miller before. He wasn't on my radar, and he put in some good shifts. So it was exciting to see what we've got a good mix right now of young and old. I think it's just that sort of middle of the pack we need to flesh out a little bit more. But by all counts, Canada's starting to look like a very effective team. And I like that they've set themselves the goal of qualifying for the next World Cup. Obviously, we know we're in it in 2026, but to not wait for that. I like that that's our ambition. And yes, lots of things that need to be worked out. We're on the right track, though. And there's a lot more to be... When has anybody ever been this optimistic about the men's Canadian national team? Ever?
Well, I mean, I think back in 2007. But... or 2000. But the...
But in terms of depth and talent coming up through it and longevity of the ability, like, this is... We're entering a new era.
That's fair. And I think that, like, you know, as much as it's... This is almost, you know, I think of it as kind of a penance walk for Canada after the rough years that they've had that they have to go through to as much as everybody should have to qualify at a certain level to say that Dominica and Canada are on the same level is just clearly not true by the results on the field. As much as this is a frustrating period in terms of, you know, results that prove things, I think that it's a positive for building relationships between the different players in the Canadian team, building their relationship with the manager, John Herdman. It's probably going to be a pretty positive period when we look back at it in retrospect.
Absolutely. And again, you got to have the long view with these things, especially national teams. These are 15-plus year projects. These are not things that get turned around in 4 or even 8 years. And I'm not saying we're at the level where we're competing with the Frances and the Belgiums of the world, or even some of the more smaller European or South American clubs, but we're on the right track. And that's the thing I think to be hopeful about, is that there's been a significant and steady shift on the upwards. And sustained, which, you know, by all counts, when you've been able to do that over a 5-6 year period, if you can hold on to that and you see the youth that are coming through the system, that, you know, at the point where Canada's really challenging teams, sure, Alphonso Davies might be Atiba Hutchinson's age. That's fine, right? Yeah. Like, I hope that that's the case. It would be great if it happened sooner, but it might not, and that's okay.
Our Canadian team, where things are in very much the near future, is the Canadian women's national team, which played in the CONCACAF Women's Championship. Well, I guess we wouldn't have covered this. Pasted Panama, I believe 5-0 off the top of my head. Did we get that? Did we get to that last time, or was that? I think that was on a Thursday.
I think we did, because we talked about their pasting of Cuba. Which one came first?
Oh, Panama was the semifinal, so it would have been
right.
So They won qualification by opening up against Panama. Christine Sinclair getting the 2 goals that she, you know, we saw in Cuba that she only got the one. Sinclair opening up a little bit more. And then you got this final. And the final in the CONCACAF Women's Championship is always strange because in Indian Olympic qualifying, because to a certain degree, you know, the two semifinalists, the two finalists have already qualified. So it's a little, the goal in the tournament is to make the Women's World Cup. So The goal has been achieved. And the only thing that you get out of this is that it's a competitive game with the trophy on the line. That being said, Canada have not prevailed for some time against the United States. In the United States looked very good in their early group games. So this kind of came off as a real testy affair. Almost the two teams seeing, you know, testing each other and taking the measure of each other 1 year in advance of the Women's World Cup.
Yeah. And I unfortunately missed this match. I want to follow up and watch it. But I think you kind of just said it, really, is the United States women's team is a better team right now. They have been for some time. And what we've seen from Canada is, again, a system where we've got some exciting new young players, but there's just a disorganization that kicks in at points where they're not defending as a unit. And the United States just plays so, so well as a team back to front. And that's what makes them so dominant. Canada has great strength and great ability in certain areas, some great technical players. But we're not at a point yet where clearly, as this result shows, where we can really confidently compete with the likes of the United States. I think where Canada sits is kind of the third or fourth best national Canadian women's national team, rather, is fair. I think that's where we deserve to be.
And that's an improvement from where we were before the successes of the two Olympic bronze medals. Because there was, even then it was kind of a view of a sort of a ceiling that was hard for Canada to crack. I think that Canada has some developing talent that's very good right now. I think this tournament was a real eye opener for people to Michelle Prince in particular, who scored 3 goals. But, you mm-hmm. know, you just look at we don't have the same strength in the midfield as to have, like, a Becky Sauerbrunn or, you know, an Abby Dalcumper.
Yeah.
In the midfield and also just sort of just the center of park in general. We're getting there, but we're not in that same sort of position, which was what was amazing to see. Sauerbrunn and Dalcumper are both defenders. Oops. But you know, they when you see them on the ball, they're so confident. What was the real positive to take out of this for Canada? The U.S. had been scoring in the opening minutes the whole tournament. Rose Lavelle scored 2 minutes in. It's hard to, you know, they were hard. Nobody was able to really figure out a way to stop that from happening. But for the grand middle part of the game, Canada played very well and were extremely lucky to hold them to the final score of 2-0. And to get as far as they did until the later stages of the game without conceding that second goal, it could have been far more. Canada got a few chances. They didn't get much in the offensive, you know, end of things. But it was really quite astounding that they went as far as they did against a team that was that dangerous.
Yeah. And, I mean, one of the things that I think Canada still needs to improve on is some good tough technical midfielders. As said, it's the middle of the park. Our defenders have gotten better. We've got a great goalkeeper now. We know we've got Christine Sinclair, the goal machine, who's probably still got another year or two of gas in the tank, maybe more.
Eight away from the record.
Exactly. And we've got exciting young talent. I mean, Jordan Heidema stood out in this series as well, of getting a whole slew of goals at only 16. Like, the future looks bright. Where that future seems a little bit more dicey, as you said, is in the middle of the park, and that ability to control play, put plays together. We do seem a little bit more organized and less frantic and a little less, you know, kick the ball over the top and hope someone gets onto it, and have a few more tactics up our sleeves, which is great to see. That being said, for me, the shots and shots on target really says it all about this game, because this has been the case many times once Canada gets a little higher up and facing tougher opponents, is that a team that can get 12 shots and 5 on target can win a game. A team that only gets 4 shots and 1 on target can't.
No.
And I think Canada's been banking on that, like the perfect cross to Sinclair or the perfect play leading up to the goal. And they need to just get a little bit more creative. And that midfield creativity is something that we've been lacking. It's gotten much better, but again, when we're looking at the Japans, the Frances, the United States, that's when things start to break down. And when we're evenly matched, you start to see where, there's just maybe lacking a little bit of creativity and a little bit of ability to hold onto the ball and create something in midfield.
The big conversation coming out of this, other than sort of, you know, on the field issues, is that Alex Morgan scores in the 89th minute, and it is immediately well known to everybody watching, the commentators, everyone right away, that the play was incredibly offside, just super super offside. The commentators were immediately talking about, this is why we need VAR in women's soccer. It has been posited that, you know, the international level, the men's game has VAR. The men's game has VAR in the World Cup. There is no guarantee that VAR will be present at the Women's World Cup. And, you know, everybody was taking it. It bothered me that everybody was taking it as this, you know, fait accompli. There needs to be VAR. There isn't VAR. Hopefully there's VAR. But, like, partially that's because the game's outcome, although it could have been a draw, like, it could have gone to penalties if, you know, a crazy counterattack had happened, notwithstanding that goal. I guess it didn't affect anything in the long run because of this strange position, anticlimactic position the game is in. But it's like Alex Morgan scores that goal and gains sole possession of the Golden Boot instead of sharing it with Adriana Leon. and pretty much everyone involved agrees that that's not deserved, and they still send her up on stage to get it, and everybody kind of acts like, well, I hope somebody fixes that by next year. Which, you know, like...
There's a glaring lack of respect for the sport from even the administration behind it.
Yeah.
That desperately needs to be addressed. Regardless of individual outcomes, it continues to seem to be a real problem that, VAR, as we know, doesn't solve everything. And I'm sure they'll bring in VAR and then everyone will hate it and talk about how it shouldn't be there. But
that's why I was saying earlier, let's in the Minnesota recap, let's not be so quick to say that VAR is ruining things, because in scenarios where VAR is not present, it's so clear how it affects the enjoyment of the game. In a way that we kind of forget when we see VAR all the time.
Absolutely. And I don't need to beat a dead horse about it, but like Spain won a World Cup off an offside goal in like the biggest tournament in the world. How many billions of people watching, and Spain wins off an clearly offside goal. That it happens, right? I mean, it's unfortunate. We don't want to see it. It still happens. And it happens with VAR. It happens without VAR.
In the meantime, between now and the Women's World Cup, where can we find you online?
You can find me online tweeting about other great MLS teams at ThatSoMLS, and on Instagram also at ThatSoMLS, where I like to post tasty little goals or moves every once in a while. If you missed something and you want to see it in the real time and not just hear us describe it, you can see Canoose on the Loose and more there. Where can we find you online?
You can find me online at Team Bates on Twitter, www.team-bates.com. I am an editor at Howler Magazine. What a Howler.com issue 15 is coming at you very quick.
Right, yes. And you have an article in it as well.
Not issue 15, right? But I'm...
Jump the gun.
My words will be appearing soon. Don't you worry.
Preview, little teaser.
You can find this podcast at thatsomls.com. Please rate, review, and subscribe.
Do those things. And until next time, don't celebrate a goal in front of the coach's son and get yourself sent off.